It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest shares the truth about animals and clears up some misconceptions about sloths, eels, and other wild and wacky creatures. First, the fire at the Husky Energy Refinery in Superior just over a week ago injured at least 20 people and led to evacuations in the area. Now city residents are trying to get back to normal, but there are still questions about health risks in Superior and safety at the refinery itself. Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hi, Rob.
Well, one concern that you wrote about, Danny, is the risk of possible soil contamination. Who's raising this concern? What are they worried about?
Well, a local professor here at the University of Minnesota Duluth, an associate professor of chemical engineering, Steve Sternberg, has said that he would limit contact with soil to avoid any long-term health problems related with the refinery fires and explosions, because he says that smoke produced partially burned fuels that contain chemicals called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. Basically, it's a group of chemicals that are released from things like burning fuels. And he says that all that stuff that went up into the air had to settle somewhere, and that's likely on the ground downwind from the area that was evacuated. So he's kind of saying that people might want to take extra precautions if they're downwind from the refinery, even though it's nothing bad if you're limiting your exposure to it.
And you talked to Jane Anklam, who's with Douglas County UW Extension. Here's a bit of what she had to say about these concerns.
The information that we have from the testing is saying that, yes, indeed, you know, there's been some fallout. It's not fallout enough to change your gardening, you know, to stop gardening or to stop eating fresh local food.
So what's going on, Danny? She mentioned testing there. Is there talk about testing people's garden soil, that sort of thing?
Well, initially they were looking into that. They were looking for some licensed labs that could do things like petrochemical testing. But they say they're not recommending any sort of testing of the soil because it's expensive, for one, for people to go out and get these kind of tests done. And, you know, there are so many different compounds that it's hard to test for whatever might be there. So it's not something that they're advising, and they don't think it's that big of a threat, you know, that people would have to take it to that level. Basically, what Jane is advising people to do is, if they live closer to the refinery and might have been downwind, then just if they plan to have a garden or work with the soil, use gloves, clean your coveralls and your gardening tools. And, you know, people really don't have to worry, she says, because plants don't normally absorb these compounds or chemicals from the soil. But people should clean or wash any vegetables before they eat them.
Do you get a sense that there is concern from some local residents despite those reassuring words?
Yeah, you know, when I talk to folks at UW Extension, they've been getting a lot of calls about it since this professor came out and said, hey, you might want to take some steps to, you know, protect yourself or your family members. And so people are basically calling them wondering, you know, is it okay for me to have a garden? Can I grow stuff this summer? Because people, you know, it's not something that usually happens up here. We live in an industrial area, but, you know, everyone wants to make sure that the soil, the water, and the air is safe. And so they're trying to answer those questions. And, you know, just on my lunch break, I saw people planting around the university today. So, you know, they're saying that that's not something that they should be worried about.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior, looking at some of the different aftermaths of the refinery explosion and fire there about 10 days ago. And Danny, both the mayors of Superior and Duluth now have called on the company, on Husky, to stop using this hydrogen fluoride, a toxic chemical. People were worried about a hydrogen fluoride tank there as this fire went on. What has the company responded?
Well, the company hasn't made any commitments to shift away from hydrogen fluoride right now. They have said basically that they're going to explore different options for the refinery structure as they rebuild, but they're not saying whether or not they would shift from that. And there was a report, I believe it was like 2011 report from the Center for Public Integrity, that said that cost for them to shift to any other type of chemical at the refinery could be somewhere in the ballpark between $50 and $150 million. So it's not a cheap option.
And last Friday, Congressman Sean Duffy, who represents the area, addressed the question of whether public funds should go to helping the company make this switch. Here's what he had to say.
This is a for-profit company. I don't know that the taxpayers across America should cover the cost of those transitions. I think if it's an appropriate move, they should make the decision and should bear the cost of that transition.
And Danny, as you're just saying, it's not a done deal that they want to make this switch anyway. Is anybody raising the issue of public money going into making the switch at the refinery?
You know, that question was raised by a reporter. I think people are asking the question about funding because they know that it would be expensive and are wondering whether or not the company would foot the bill if they were to, you know, pursue that option to shift to another type of chemical. And obviously people are really concerned about the use of this chemical as they've learned more about it, because only about a third of refineries nationwide use this chemical. Others use things like sulfuric acid or ionic catalysts to make high-octane gasoline. So, you know, the mayors here in Duluth and Superior made themselves clear that they'd like to see that ended and like to see the company examine other options and how much that would cost. And so I think that's why that question came up, because people are wondering if they can make it happen.
And now some people are making claims, filing claims with Husky, talking about the damages that they incurred. What kind of claims are we seeing here against the company?
Well, as of this morning, there are just under 1,500 claims that have been submitted. And most of those claims have to do with things like, you know, costs related to the evacuation, followed by lost income. Husky Energy's spokeswoman Kim Guttormson says that very few of those have to do with anything involving injury.
And there are some medical claims. I understand that the company is requiring a release before agreeing on any kind of settlement. Do you know anything about the progress of those few injury or medical claims?
Well, if people are going to pursue a bodily injury claim, they would be required to sign a waiver, as you've said. And in that case, they would have to do a medical release form, which would be standard procedure according to the company. But that would only happen once a settlement had been reached with that person. So, you know, I'm not certain whether anything new has come out with that.
And Danny, when we talked last, there was you had said that there's going to be a long stretch, it looks like, of study here looking at what happened to the factory and, of course, a long cleanup. Can you talk about the state of affairs at the refinery itself now?
Well, the refinery right now, I mean, there's a lot of work being done to gather and collect evidence by the Chemical Safety Board. They're looking into how this explosion occurred at the refinery. They're going to be doing what's called a metallurgical analysis, or they're going to be looking at metals in what's called a fluid catalytic cracking unit, because that's where the initial explosion occurred. So they're going to look at the metals related to that unit to see if there were any cracks or fatigue that may have resulted in its failure and caused the problems there. So that's one thing. They're requesting documents from management. They're collecting interviews from employees and photos. I was going to follow up with the agency to see if they have been able to actually enter the refinery, which was something that they were not able to do yet last week because of stability concerns of all the damage that had, you know, resulted from the explosions and fires. And then, of course, they're going to have OSHA investigating worker safety there. And the OSHA investigation could take the next 6 months, and it could be two or three times as long for the Chemical Safety Board's investigation to wrap up.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for WPR in Superior. She was with us to talk about the aftermath of the Husky Energy fire in Superior. Here's what a sloth sounds like. I didn't know what a sloth sounded like until I dug up that audio there. And thanks to our next guest, it turns out there's a lot I didn't know about sloths. and a bunch of other creatures. She says we often get things wrong about sloths, eels, hippos, and a whole lot of other animals because we try to understand them on human terms. Lucy Cook is a zoologist and science writer. Her new book is The Truth About Animals, Stone Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife. Lucy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you write about all these misunderstood animals in your book, and you make the point that we know a lot in the world of science. There's still a lot we don't know about how animals behave.
Absolutely. We've still got, there are still many great mysteries out there for us to solve. Things like, for instance, why we sleep, why animals sleep. We still don't really know what the purpose of sleep is. So that there are still many mysteries out there for us to try and figure out.
I want to dig into some of the individual animals you talk about, the mysteries and some of the misconceptions about them. And I want to start with one of your favorites. You're the founder of the Sloth Appreciation Society, and you write that people ask you all the time, why do we have sloths? How do they survive when they're so slow and lazy? What do you tell them?
Well, yes, I get asked a lot why how sloths can exist when they're such losers. and people are convinced that because they're slow and lazy, they're somehow redundant and second rate. But they are actually incredibly successful animals. They are, and the reason for their success is their slothful nature, because they are energy-saving icons. They have a whole suite of extraordinary adaptations that enable them to have to burn very little energy and have very low energy requirements. The leaves that they eat are mildly toxic and they contain very little energy. So they survive on about 160 calories a day, which
wow.
is about the same as a packet of chips. And we'd be pretty peckish if we were if we were surviving on 160 calories a day. But one of the ways the sloth has managed to evolve to use so little energy is by turning its life upside down. You see, and an inverted existence, hanging from a tree, requires half the muscle mass of an upright existence, where your body has to hold itself erect, and that burns energy. So their topsy-turvy lifestyle may seem strange to us, but is actually incredibly energy efficient.
And people look at them and say, wow, they're so slow, but I guess if they're eating leaves, they don't need to be too fast to catch them. And you write, their predators are often a kind of bird, an eagle, I think it was, and sloths are surprisingly stealthy at hiding from their predators.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it may not be our idea of aspirational living to be covered in algae and hopping with insects, but it really works for the sloth. You know, they merge in with the trees. They're incredibly hard to see. As I know myself from having spent many years searching for them in jungles, they're very, very cryptic. And their movements are so slow. By moving so slowly, they slip under the radar of harpy eagles, which, as you say, these sort of terrifying, massive eagles. They swoop around the tree tops, scanning for movement. Unlike monkeys, which crash around a lot, sloths are very, very stealthy. So they avoid detection.
Why are we so unfair to the sloth? I mean, they're named after one of the deadly sins. I don't think there's another animal out there that shares that distinction. Why are we so down on sloths?
Well, I think that around the time when the sloth was named, it got its name was around the time of the formation of the seven deadly sins. And I think that there was a whole sort of period of zoology when the bestiaries, these sort of medieval encyclopedias first came out, that was very judgmental about animals, and they were looking for sort of moral tales in animal behavior. And I think to a certain extent, we still do moralize about animals, and we can be quite judgmental. And, you know, we are busy bipedal apes that are obsessed with moving faster than nature intended. We think speed is incredibly sexy and something that we should strive after, you know. But actually, being slothful and stealthy is a very sustainable way of living. And I think maybe we should be less focused on being like cheetahs, and maybe we could learn a thing or two from the sloth.
I watched some of your videos of baby sloths, one where they were learning to climb. And this is still human-centric of me, but I think people watching these videos is really going to turn people around on their thoughts about the sloth. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they are unfeasibly cute. I mean, they really are.
They are
sort of, and you know, I mean, because they're born with a natural smile on their face, and you know, and they love, and they need to hug, you know. So I mean, there's a sort of incredibly endearing nature to them, and they have these adorable faces. And the thing that I love about sloths so much is that, unlike, say, pandas or meerkats, which basically to human beings all look the same, sloths have got incredibly unique faces. Each one has a different, a very characterful face. And so I never get bored of taking their photograph or filming them, because each one is different, you know, and charming in its own way.
Talking to Lucy Cook, her new book is The Truth About Animals, Stone Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife. Lucy, I want to turn to an animal that I think people will find less cute. But you were into these when you were a kid, eels. Why were you almost obsessed with eels growing up?
Oh, because I go, it was so hard to catch. They're incredibly slippery, and so I was very obsessed with ponds when I was little, and pond life, and I was always trying to. My dad and I would go out sort of hunting for frogs and insects and beetles to put in my ponds that I had at home. And I could, and the eels that we caught, I could never hold on to them because they're so slippery. And I was sort of delighted to discover that throughout science, eels have fascinated scientists. For many, many years, all the way from Aristotle, who was like the first great zoologist, and he was obsessed with eels because he couldn't find their sexual organs. They appeared to be sexless, and so he came up with the idea that they must therefore spontaneously generate, and that the action of water on mud would somehow make them just emerge from the ground, which is a sort of ridiculous idea, obviously, to us now, and I. But if you think about it, it's no more ridiculous than the truth, which we now believe is that eels start their life in the Sargasso Sea, which is a very obscure, remote part of the Atlantic that's slap bang in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And then they swim thousands of kilometers, no bigger than the grain of rice. They make this epic journey that takes 1 or 2 years to the rivers of Europe, or indeed the rivers of America. And then they spend years fattening themselves up in fresh water, only so that they have enough energy in order to make the long journey back to the Sargasso in order to reproduce and then die. But working out that extraordinary migration, which is just epic in nature, was something that troubled and tormented scientists, including Sigmund Freud, in fact. Sigmund Freud, who's obviously famous as the inventor of psychoanalysis, his first job as an academic was spent slicing up eels for a summer in search of their testicles, which it took scientists forever to find their sexual organs, and because they go through four metamorphoses, and only in the fourth and final metamorphosis, as they're heading back from the rivers to the Sargasso, do they develop them. So they were incredibly hard to find, and Freud was one of the scientists who was tormented by this, which I think is rather amusing.
I don't want to read too much into it. I guess sometimes an eel is just an eel.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it's a slightly phallocentric fish that tormented him, you know, so it's a kind of like a strange thing. He gave up and went after less slippery subjects like the human psyche.
And speaking of misconceptions about animals, the eel, for a long time, until surprisingly recently, people thought eels were vegetarians. They love their lentils.
Yes, exactly. I know, I found some incredibly charming old myths about animals, and one of them was, yes, there was an idea that eels were vegetarians, and they would come out of the rivers at night and forage for peas and lentils on the land, and that was something that was believed in the Middle Ages, and of course, isn't true. Eels are actually voracious carnivores, and there was an experiment that was done by a couple of Frenchmen where they placed, I think it was something like 200 or 300 young eels in a tank together and fed them regularly, but nevertheless they still ate one another until there was only one enormous eel left.
So it's a good thing you didn't find one for your pond, in hindsight.
Yes, exactly. One for my lovely pond as a child, it would have eaten all the other inmates of my pond, so probably just as well.
I want to check out a couple other misconceptions about animals. We've heard about the vegetarian eel. Nope. Mm-hmm. The self-harming hippo. People looked at hippos and thought, these guys are bleeding. They're cutting themselves up on purpose. What's the story there?
Well, so this is really fascinating, and another one of those very sort of charming old myths. So in Roman times, it was believed that hippos were the inventors of bloodletting, because they exude this red liquid. They do actually look like they're bleeding. The first time I saw a hippo, I also thought that it was bleeding. So they have this red liquid that seeps out of their skin, and it looks exactly like blood. So the Romans, who were into bloodletting as a form of medicine, if you were suffering from any number of ailments, somebody would come and let your blood cut you to sort of release the pressure, and that was a common cure in those days. And they thought that the hippo was the inventor of phlebotomy, as it was known. But actually, what's going on is the hippo is excreting this red liquid, which is actually a sunscreen. It's a sunscreen which has also antibacterial qualities to it, and possibly even insect repellent. So it's an incredibly sophisticated sunscreen. So in a way, the hippo did invent a pharmaceutical process, but it wasn't bloodletting. It was actually sunscreen.
And Lucy, as we wrap up, in a lot of the stories you tell, not just the ones we talked about, it seems like we run into trouble when we try to put human terms on the animals we're studying. So, oh, the sloth, that's like a lazy human. Hippos are like this form of healthcare. Chimpanzees, you're right, we were researching to see how human-like we were. Are we better off just trying to figure them out on their own terms and not put our preconceptions on them?
Absolutely. I think it's almost irresistible for us to anthropomorphize animals and to look for our reflection in the animal kingdom. And, you know, that's perfectly fine in kids' books. You know, that's fine. But I think that you can't assume that animals, you understand them because they look like they're behaving in a way that is familiar to us. So if we need to really understand the context of their lives and I think respect them for what they are and not what we want them to be.
Lucy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lucy Cook, author of The Truth About Animals, Stoned Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife. When you live in a city that offers all your basic needs and plenty of entertainment, it can be easy to spend all your time in that one place. But chances are there are a few smaller communities, neighboring cities that could enrich your life with a few regular visits. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Where do you live and do you visit neighboring cities or small towns? Do you get outside of your immediate area to check out what's going on? The restaurants maybe, the park, whatever is in that local community. What have you found off of the beaten path in your part of the state? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike Paulus is a writer and online editor at Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire, where he wrote about our tendency to stick with what we know. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, what got you started down this mental path, Mike?
Well, I grew up here in Eau Claire, and I also went to college here. So I guess I could consider myself kind of a college kid towny hybrid. So that would expose me to a lot of stuff, especially with people from outside the community. And I would get kind of sick of my fellow students putting down Eau Claire and saying, you know, I can't wait to get out of here. It's just kind of a stereotypical thing to say, like, as soon as graduation comes, I'm out of here. And I got kind of defensive about that because this is my hometown. And about the best criticism I could aim against my fellow students were, well, you never leave campus. You know, apart from the grocery store or the street with all the bars on it, you've never been out to see this city that you're criticizing. You know, there's a whole community around you that you're not aware of. So I felt pretty good being judgy like that, which is to say I was pretty full of myself. When I was in college and a little after college, I still had that attitude. And then I got older, and I started thinking about, you know, my own adult habits and where I spend my time, and just like those college students, I figured out that I really wasn't traveling very far outside of my comfort zone. And it's a phenomenon that I've called why the heck would I drive to Chippewa, referring to Chippewa Falls, which is just about 20 minutes away from Eau Claire. And I think that's a pretty common and crazy attitude to have, because Eau Claire is so close to places like Chippewa Falls and Menominee. You know, like I said, 20 minutes away. For me, driving across town and driving to Chippewa Falls are almost the same thing as far as the time you spend in the car. So I had to kind of rethink my thinking on that and not be quite so judgmental.
And your story, Mike, is specific to the Eau Claire area, and it's totally, I'm guessing, not at all specific to the Eau Claire area. There can be that similar debate in any city, pretty much of any size around the state, right?
Oh, I'd absolutely agree. There's just I don't even want to call it a psychological block. I would call it a psychological mountain range between, you know, the cities and the area that you live. And I don't know why that is or what makes it happen. If it's the way you were raised or if, you know, maybe me personally, maybe I'm just too lazy to get up and do that. But I do know that I'm pretty comfortable where I am. And that probably keeps me, you know, in my place.
And in answer to your question, why the heck would you go to Chippewa, meaning Chippewa Falls, you've come up with reasons. There are perfectly great reasons to head over there, right?
Yeah, there's Chippewa Falls and Menominee and even the much smaller surrounding communities. There's reasons to visit all of them if you just take the time to do that. It's really the unknown and not knowing and feeling kind of uncomfortable and like you don't have your bearings that kind of closes you off from all those experiences you could be having in the community surrounding you.
You know, I think when I go to visit people in bigger cities around the country, like New York or whatever, the only time they might go to that museum or something, you know, a little further away from their neck of the woods is when somebody comes in from outside the city. Once you live in a place, maybe you take those opportunities. If you just got up and went a little distance, you'd start to take them for granted.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, too. I know I have family that grew up in the suburbs around the Twin Cities, and I just blindly assumed that, oh, they must have been in the cities all the time, going to the museums and the sports games and the big concerts and stuff, but I found out that's not the case. And the same thing happens there, too, that those experiences are kind of taken for granted and just kind of left there.
Talking to Mike Paulus from Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire, he says, okay, you've got the place you live, you like it, you've got your maybe routine, the places you like to go. Now pick that community nearby. Realize it's not such a big hurdle to get over there and check it out. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you feel like you're in the same boat as Mike and you don't get out and see that stuff nearby, or if you do that sort of thing. Let us know what kind of treasures you found, maybe the next town over from where you are. So, Mike, have you found a prescription for yourself? Have you gotten motivated to say, okay, I'm going to leave the city boundaries and check out something cool?
Yeah, I think I have on occasion, for sure. It's really interesting because with my job, I work at a magazine that deals with cultural happenings and events, and so I'm very much aware of what's going on in these other towns, but even that was not enough to get me to go over there. So knowing what's going on is only part of the battle. But I think you should definitely try to figure out what is going on. And I think, you know, if you find yourself in one of those towns, like if you're running an errand or something, because I know that happens, as long as you're there, take some time to just explore a little bit. I winded up in Chippewa Falls a couple summers ago because I was looking for a part for my dryer. And the little shop in downtown Chippewa Falls was the only place that had that part. And while I was there with the kids, I thought, well, let's do something while we're here. And we went to a park and an ice cream shop, and the kids had a blast. And I was probably the better for it. And I got my part for the dryer, too.
Oh, good. And the dryer's working?
It didn't, no.
Oh, sorry. But you mentioned the kids. And I definitely find that, you know, having kids, especially when they were younger, was a great motivator for going out and finding something new, just to, you know, because you're constantly looking for ways to entertain them. Has that helped motivate you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Introducing to, you know, your kids to the things that you love and the things that you wish you had been exposed to is a great motivator to get out of the house. I was kind of hesitant to bring that up too much because I know a lot of people don't have kids, you know, so like what do those people do? But absolutely, yeah, the kids get you going. There's a lot of kids events, and there's just a lot of always on everyday things in these other towns that you should go explore.
Now, with the older kids, the college students you started off with, I mean, has anything changed since you were in school, or do you keep seeing the new batch of Eau Claire college students coming in and going to the same haunts and hangouts and not really straying away from that?
Well, I think there's definitely a set of kids that, I shouldn't say kids, you know, young adults, that definitely just kind of stick to their routines. And I know college can be a overwhelming time, so sometimes you need that routine. So there are definitely the same kind of set of students who are staying in the same spots. But I will add that I think liking the town you're in and loving things that are local has become a lot cooler than it was when I was in school. And so I think there is a source of pride if you can be the one who knows what's going on in the place you're living and in your community. And I think that you almost get bragging rights for knowing what's going on. So I am seeing a lot more of that than when I was in school.
And I think technology could maybe change this, because I've definitely been in the position. I'm in a town for whatever reason, not a drier part, but something. And then I can, like, scroll around on the map and say, oh, there's a restaurant that sounds cool, or, oh, hey, there's green space, there's some kind of park there. Let's check it out. Has that helped your navigation of your region?
Oh, yeah, big time. I'm not very good with directions, which my wife will tell you. So I have a lot more confidence going to a place I've never been now that I've got, you know, my phone and my maps on it. And I think you can use those resources to kind of invent ways to explore the area. You can kind of design a little which isn't like something you necessarily do in one day, but you could spread it out over time and try to visit all the, you know, local breweries in your area, or coffee shops, or you could get a little more fancy and do some research and try to visit all the haunted locations and all the places that you're going. So that's kind of fun by itself. But as you start ticking off those places and have a reason to go there, the side effect is that you're demystifying them, so which makes you more likely to visit them again because they're not so unknown to you.
Talking to Mike Paulus, writer and online editor at Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire. He wrote a piece there encouraging us to try harder to visit communities, towns, places near to where we live. Get outside of our neighborhood, our city limits, and check out the cool stuff around us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you do? Are you a tourist in your own part of the state? Do you get outside of the town and check out cool stuff? What have you discovered? A hidden gem that was maybe only a 5-15 minute ride, whatever. A natural area, a cool restaurant or business or landscape, you name it. Or is this something you have a hard time doing, you always mean to, but you haven't done it yet? Call in for some inspiration. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about exploring towns and spaces just outside of where we live. Mike Paulus is with us, writer and online editor for Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire. He says, you know, maybe you get caught up in that rut. You know what's right there. Check out the next town over, the next county over, and find the cool stuff there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you do or have a hard time doing, wish you did more? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Judy is with us in Ripon. Judy, hi.
Hi. We found that our son, when he was little, was in hockey, and so that took us to a lot of different small towns in Wisconsin that had rinks that did small tournaments and so forth. And when we did that, we were able to find small towns that we would not have traveled to otherwise. And then you make a point of really going and seeing those small businesses in those areas. And it's a really great way, too, for kids to see that the kids from the other towns aren't, you know, just their adversaries on the ice, but that they're really cool kids, too. So it was a really neat way for us to see other small towns in Wisconsin.
And, Judy, did that set you on a habit even after the hockey days or when hockey wasn't in season, you'd maybe take a trip, or was it just during the season?
No, we did. We said, oh, we've been there before. Let's go there again because we'd find a restaurant that we liked or things like that. And so we did. We visited those towns on more than one occasion.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Judy. And as a sports parent myself, Mike, I've done a lot of that. Again, I mean, again, not everybody has kids to drag them along to do this sort of thing, but those kids can drag us along even if we don't want to go.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. Yep.
Judy, thanks a lot for that call. And Mike, do you do like food tourism much at all? So you talked about finding restaurants. I know I've found great restaurants in towns after soccer games, for example. Is that something you seek out when you're checking out a new place?
Yeah, it is. You know, food is kind of a real universal thing. I mean, you know that there's probably going to be a place to eat, and you're probably going to be hungry at some point. So that's a great entry point to a city. My wife and I, even before we had kids, had a good time taking alternate routes to places and, you know, kind of exploring small towns and finding the local diner and seeing what it was like there, just to walk in and have a cup of coffee or a meal. And so it wasn't even just about finding a great restaurant. It was just about getting closer to the people who live in that town and seeing what they're like. So, yeah, food is a great way to get into that.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to another Judy now. Judy in Appleton. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I have a funny one. I live in Appleton, and up down the street from me is a business that I passed for the last 2 years until I saw it advertised on one of the local TV stations. I wondered, wonder what's in there. And so I went in. Here it is, a bakery that is all gluten-free bakery, and it was really nice in there. And I'm going, oh, anybody that doesn't that wants something gluten-free, there it is. It was called Happy Bellies. Now, I thought it was maybe a store for pregnant people or something. And here it was, a bakery with gluten-free.
And how many times, Judy, did you drive by and think, oh, I ought to check that out?
2 years.
2 years worth. Okay. Thank you. So that one's just down the street, Mike. And that's, you know, you mentioned going off the beaten path, taking the other route. And sometimes I think, I'll speak for myself, but probably a lot of people you're invested in, I'm going to a place, I'm going to get there. I'm not going to stop along the way. And every now and then I kick myself for not stopping and checking out that thing that looked kind of cool along the way.
Oh, yeah, that is one thing that my wife was very much into. And when she went to college in Eau Claire, she used to love to just walk around the city, which I never did. And that translated to driving, you know, after we got married. And so when we're going somewhere, for her, it's really all about what you're seeing along the way. And that takes an attitude adjustment, for sure, because I'm always focused on getting where I got to go. And that is how you miss those places. That's how you drive by those bakeries that are only right down the street from your house.
Judy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Elizabeth with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a traveling teacher, and so I have been in locations on the eastern and western side of the state, and I've seen art displays, historical displays, natural kinds of things in nature, coffee shops, chocolate shops, restaurants, museums, farm stands, and, you know, during a lunch break or even going back and investigating them, it's just been so much fun to get local flavor outside of Madison.
So, Elizabeth, it would be really easy for you, I think, probably to drive to the work site wherever you're teaching on either side of the state and then get done and drive straight back home. Do you make a point of carving out a little time to check out the local scene?
I do, either at my lunchtime or afterward, or even bringing the family back. So it's been really exciting. There's a lot out there that people don't know about, and it's fun to explore.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for sharing that. And Mike, that's kind of the key. Like, we can get in that daily rut or the work rut and carving out that little bit of time to check out the cool stuff.
Yeah, it absolutely is. One other thing that I've tried, too, is that if there's something you like doing in your city, but you're getting kind of bored of it, or maybe you haven't done it for a while because it became kind of routine in your own town, the next town over probably has something similar, so you can go do it there, which just kind of refreshes that activity for you and makes it a little bit different. But you still kind of know what you're getting into. So if you like the trail system around your town, try it in the next town, because, you know, at least you're doing something you're used to, but you're seeing new things. And so that's kind of a way to introduce yourself to another community.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mike Paulus from Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. He says, hey, get outside your local community limits, outside of your neighborhood, your town. Check out what's going on. There's a lot of great stuff in Wisconsin. There's probably something great in the next city over, the small town, maybe a 15, 20-minute drive away. You can join in. Some lines have opened up at 800-642-1234. Is this something you've done? Have you found a hidden treasure, maybe just 15 minutes or so from your house? 800-642-1234. 1234 is the number. Dan is with us now. He's on I-94 headed to Michigan. Dan, hi.
How you doing, guys?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Dan?
I just left Eau Claire. I made a delivery up in Thorpe, Wisconsin, and I'd never been there in my life. I didn't even know it existed. But it was so unusual to go into a small town because I drive a truck from Newton, Wisconsin. It's right south of Manitowoc. So I'm all over the state. But the gentleman that writes this column in this magazine, he's absolutely right. If you don't get out of the redundancy of your community and explore, well, you might have to go 15, 20 miles, not even that, 10 miles. You might see something totally different that opens up your mind, opens up a door, so to speak, a window, that you can see things differently and experience things differently. You know, and there's things just around Wisconsin that are amazing, just amazing.
Dan, thank you so much. And Mike, he's on your wavelength, it sounds like. It's not just for fun. We're actually learning something. We're opening our minds to something different.
Yeah, I think it is really as much about shifting your attitude as it is discovering stuff around you. I love talking to people who moved here from larger communities and large cities, and how I love seeing their eye roll when they hear people talk about commute times and, you know, quote unquote rush hour in our city, which is basically non-existent. I just saw a comment on our Facebook page from somebody about this, saying that they grew up 20 miles north of Milwaukee, and it was nothing for them to drive like 60 minutes for dinner, not dinner and something else, just dinner. And then they got a job in Chippewa Falls and lived in Eau Claire, and people would gasp at the 19-mile, you know, commute that they were doing. And so it's really eye-opening when you talk to somebody from outside your area and get their take on you know, your place, the place you grew up, because they might know a little bit more about it than you do with those outside eyes.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Linda in Germantown. Linda, hi.
Hi there. I would like to recommend that you Google a website called The Park Next Door. And on their site, they have different areas like nature centers, nature preserves, parks, sculpture gardens, and even some cemeteries. And I found a place in Colgate, a sculpture garden that I had driven past the sign for a number of years, and finally on Easter Sunday we went and explored it. Totally free, and it's an outdoor like metal artwork design area that you can walk through and take your kids or whatever. But it gives you a lot of options for free things to do, and a lot of them are nature, and so that's a good site to check out.
Linda, thanks a lot. ParkNextDoor.com, I believe that is. Thanks for the call. Mike, as we start to wrap up, have you had any great outings lately, or do you have one lined up maybe for next weekend?
Next weekend, what are you doing? I do have kids, so it's...
Yeah, no, I know how that is.
There are some real hidden gems around here. I know in Menominee, we're very proud to know about what we call the Castle Park, which is, there is an absolutely massive playground in Menominee, which is a public playground, but it's part of a grade school, so I think maybe people don't think to go there. But it's huge, and it was built to look like the Mabeltainer Theater, which is a historic building in Menominee, and it's such a great park for kids. And you got to get into the city to find that. And it's got a great story behind it. It was funded by a lot of the parents in the surrounding neighborhood. And that's not on the main stretch down
there.
You got to kind of go find it. And word of mouth helps a lot, because as soon as we found that, we were telling everybody about it.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Mike Paulus, writer and online editor at Volume 1 Magazine. You can keep sharing your local, maybe hidden treasures, your discoveries over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin is going Guinness record crazy these days. In the last couple of months, I've talked about the record for the most high fives in a minute. That was in Milwaukee, and a teacher who made 261 clay pots in 1 hour. Now the current record holder for the most Big Macs eaten has extended his record. Don Gorski of Fond du Lac has eaten 30,000 Big Macs in 1 hour. No, I just made that up. He ate 30,000 Big Macs in his entire lifetime. That's still a lot. Gorski got the official record back in 2016 when he hit 28,788. He's kept record of the Big Macs he's eaten going back to 1972. And another record may be on the way. Wisconsin National Guard Sergeant Will Koken is planning to run in the Cellcom Green Bay Marathon later this month, carrying a 100-pound rucksack on his back. So this is 26-plus miles, 100-pound rucksack, and if he can pull this off in about 6.5 hours, he'll set a record. He's raising money, by the way, for a veterans group along the way. So what would you want to set a world record for? What could you get a world record for? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. Dean Kinetter's at the board today. I'm guessing your record, Dean, you can nod, would involve eating cheese in some way. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's aiming for that. Let us know your record hopes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.